change the subject. For the Indians, cricket is not a game, it's a religion. And we're guests of the president of the MCC. Yes, Freddie Brown and I both played for the MCC, and he went on to captain England, Giles said, as he parked his car on a yellow line outside the ground. However, you're about to find that cricket is a great leveller. There's sure to be an interesting mix of guests in the president's box who only have one thing in common, a passion for the game. Then I'll be the odd one out, said Seb. The Cabinet Office? It's Harry Clifton. Could I have a word with the Cabinet Secretary? Hold on, please, sir. I'll find out if he's free. Mr. Clifton, said a voice a few moments later. What a pleasant surprise. I was only asking your brother-in-law the other day if there had been any progress in getting Anatoly Babakov released. Sadly not, Sir Alan, but that wasn't the reason I was calling. I need to see you fairly urgently on a private matter. I wouldn't bother you unless I considered it important. If you say it's important, Mr. Clifton, I'll see you whenever it's convenient. And I don't always say that, even to cabinet ministers. I am in London today to visit my publishers, so if by any chance you could fit me in for 15 minutes this afternoon... Let me check my diary. Ah, I see the Prime Minister is at Lord's to watch the test match, where he'll have an unofficial meeting with Indira Gandhi, so I don't expect him back at number 10, much before 6. Would 4:15 suit you? Good morning, Freddy. It was kind of you to invite us. My pleasure, Giles. Nice to be on the same side for a change. Giles laughed. And this is my nephew, Sebastian Clifton, who works in the city. Good morning, Mr. Brown, said Sebastian, as he shook hands with the president of the MCC. He looked out onto the magnificent ground, which was quickly filling up in anticipation of the opening salvos. England won the toss and have elected to bat, said the president. Good toss to win, said Giles. And is this your first visit to the home of cricket, Sebastian? No, sir. As a schoolboy, I saw my uncle score a century for Oxford on this ground. Not many people have achieved that, said the president, as two of his other guests entered the box and came across to join them. Sebastian smiled, although he was no longer looking at the former captain of England. And this, said the president, is an old friend of mine, Suki Guman, not a bad spin bowler in his time, and his daughter Priya. Good morning, Mr. Guman, said Giles. Do you enjoy cricket, Priya? Seb asked the young woman, whom he tried not to stare at. That's rather a silly question to ask an Indian woman, Mr. Clifton, said Priya, because there wouldn't be anything to talk to our men about if we didn't follow cricket. How about you? Uncle Giles played for the MCC, but when bowlers see me, they don't expect it to be a lasting experience. She smiled. And I heard your uncle say you work in the city. Yes, I'm at Farthing's Bank. And you, are you over here on holiday? No, said Priya. Like you, I work in the city. Sebastian felt embarrassed. What do you do? He asked. I'm a senior analyst at Hambro's. Let's wind back, Seb wanted to say. How interesting, he managed, as a bell rang and rescued him. They both looked out onto the ground to see two men in long white coats striding down the pavilion steps, a signal to the packed crowd that battle was about to commence. Mr. Clifton, what a pleasure to see you again, said the Cabinet Secretary as the two men shook hands. What's the tea time score? Asked Harry. England are 71 for 5. Someone called Beddy is taking us apart. I rather hope they beat us this time, admitted Harry. That's nothing less than high treason, said Sir Alan, but I'll pretend I didn't hear it. And, by the way, congratulations on the worldwide success of Anatoly Babakov's book. You played your own role in making that possible, Sir Alan. A minor role. After all, cabinet secretaries are not meant to appear on the stage, but be satisfied with prompting others from the wings. Can I get you a tea or coffee? No, thank you, said Harry. And as I don't want to take up any more of your time than necessary, I'll get straight to the point. Sir Alan leant back in his chair. Some years ago, you asked me to travel to Moscow on behalf of Her Majesty's government to carry out a private mission, which you did in an exemplary manner. You may recall that I was required to memorize the names of a group of Russian agents operating in this country, and to pass those names on to you. And most useful that has proved to be. One of the names on that list was an agent called Pengele. The cabinet secretary reverted to being an expressionless mandarin. I was rather hoping that is no more than a coincidence. The wall of silence prevailed. How stupid of me, said Harry. Of course, you'd already worked out the significance of that particular name. Thanks to you, said Sir Alan. Has my brother-in-law been informed? Another question that remained unanswered. Is that entirely fair, Sir Alan? Possibly not, but espionage is a dirty business, Mr. Clifton. One doesn't exchange calling cards with the enemy. But Giles is deeply in love with Pengele's daughter, and I know he wants to marry her. She is not Pengele's daughter, said Sir Alan. It was Harry's turn to be struck dumb. She's a highly trained Stasi agent. The whole operation was a set-up from the beginning, which we're monitoring closely. But Giles is bound to find out in time, and then all hell will be let loose. You may be right, but until then my colleagues have to consider the bigger picture. As you did with my son Sebastian some years ago. I will regret that decision for the rest of my life, Mr. Clifton. And I suspect you will regret this one, too, Sir Alan. I don't think so. If I were to tell Lord Barrington the truth about Karen Brandt, many of our agents' lives would be put in danger. Then what's to stop me telling him? The Official Secrets Act. Are you absolutely confident that I wouldn't go behind your back? I am, Mr. Clifton, because if I know one thing about you, it's that you would never betray your country. You're a bastard, said Harry. That's part of my job description, said Sir Alan. Harry would often visit his mother at her cottage on the estate during his 4 to 6 p.m. writing break, when they would enjoy what Maisie described as high tea, cheese and tomato sandwiches, hot scones with honey, eclairs, and Earl Grey tea. They would discuss everything from the family, her greatest interest, to the politics of the day. She didn't care much for Jim Callaghan or Ted Heath, and only once, straight after the war, had voted anything other than liberal. A wasted vote, Giles never stopped reminding you. A wasted vote is when you don't vote, as I've told him many times. Harry couldn't help but notice that since her late husband had died, his mother had slowed down. She no longer walked the dog every evening, and recently she'd even cancelled the morning papers, unwilling to admit her eyesight was failing. "Must get back to my 6 to 8 session," said Harry. As he rose from his seat by the fire, his mother handed him a letter. "Not to be opened until they've laid me to rest," she said calmly. "That won't be for some years, Mother," he said, as he bent down and kissed her on the forehead, although he didn't believe it. "So, are you glad you took the day off?" Giles asked Sebastian as they walked back through the grace gates after Stumps. "Yes, I am," said Seb. "Thank you." "What a glorious partnership between Knott and Dillingworth. They may have saved the day for England." "I agree." "Did you have a chance to chat to Mick Jagger?" "No, I didn't speak to him." "What about Don Bradman?" "I shook his hand." "Peter O'Toole?" "Couldn't understand a word he said." "Paul Getty?" "We exchanged cards." "What about the Prime Minister?" I didn't realize he was there. From this scintillating exchange, Sebastian, should I conclude that you were distracted by a certain young lady?
Yes.
And are you hoping to see her again?
Possibly.
Are you listening to a word I'm saying?
No.
The three of them met once a week, ostensibly to discuss matters concerning Mellor Travel, on whose board they all sat. But as they didn't always want their fellow directors to know what they were up to, the meeting was neither minuted nor official. The unholy trinity, as Sebastian referred to them, consisted of Desmond Mellor, Adrian Sloane, and Jim Knowles. They only had one thing in common, a mutual hatred of anyone named Clifton or Barrington. After Mellor had been forced to resign from the board of Barrington's, and Sloane was dismissed as chairman of Farthing's Bank, while Knowles departed from the shipping company without any regrets being minuted, they had become bound together by a common thread, to gain control of Farthing's Bank, and then take over Barrington Shipping Company, by fair means or foul.
"I am able to confirm," said Mellor, as they sat quietly in the corner of one of the few London clubs that would have them as members, "that Lady Virginia has reluctantly sold me her 7.5% holding in Barrington Shipping, which will allow one of us to take a seat on the board."
"Good news," said Knowles. "I'm only too happy to volunteer for the job."
"No need to be in such a rush," said Mellor. "I think I'll leave our fellow directors to consider the possible consequences of whoever I might select, so that every time the boardroom door opens, Mrs. Clifton will wonder which one of us is about to appear."
"That's a job I would also relish," chipped in Sloane.
"Don't hold your breath," said Mellor, "because what neither of you know is that I already have a representative on the board. One of Barrington's longest-serving directors," he continued, "is experiencing a little financial difficulty, and has recently approached me for a fairly hefty loan that I feel sure he has no chance of repaying. So, from now on, not only will I be getting the minutes of every board meeting, but also any inside information Mrs. Clifton doesn't want recorded. So, now you know what I've been up to during the past month. What have you two got to offer?"
"Quite a bit," said Knowles. "I recently heard that Saul Kaufman only retired as chairman of Kaufman's after everyone at the bank, including the doorman, realized he had Alzheimer's. His son Victor, who couldn't organize a piss-up in a brewery, has temporarily taken his place while they look for a new chairman."
"Then this must be our best chance to make a move," said Mellor.
"I wish it were that easy," said Knowles. "But unfortunately, young Kaufman has begun negotiating a merger with Farthing's. He and Sebastian Clifton were at school together, even shared a study, so Clifton's got the inside track."
"Then let's make sure he trips up as he comes round the final bend," said Sloane.
"I also picked up another useful piece of information," continued Knowles. "It seems that Ross Buchanan intends to step down as chairman of Farthing's sometime in the new year, and Hakeem Bishara will take his place, with Clifton as CEO of the newly formed Farthing's Kaufman Bank."
"Will the Bank of England go along with such a cozy little arrangement?"
"They'll turn a blind eye, especially now Bishara has ingratiated himself with the city. He somehow managed to get himself accepted as part of the establishment."
"But," interjected Mellor, "doesn't the new government legislation demand that any proposed bank merger has to be vetted by the city regulators? So there's nothing to stop us putting in a counterbid and stirring things up."
"What's the point, when we couldn't begin to challenge Bishara's deep pockets? All we could do is hold the process up, and even that wouldn't come cheap, as we found to our cost last time."
"Is there anything else we can do to prevent the merger?" asked Mellor.
"We could so damage Bishara's reputation with the Bank of England," said Sloane, "that they wouldn't consider him a fit and proper person to run one of the city's large financial institutions."
"We tried that once before," Mellor reminded him, "and failed."
only because our plan wasn't foolproof. This time, I've come up with something that will make it impossible for the city regulators to allow the merger to go ahead. And Bashara would have to resign as chairman of Farthings.
How can that be possible? Asked Mellor.
Because convicted criminals are not allowed to serve on the board of a bank.
Chapter 16.
Am I ugly?
Need you ask?
Said Clive Bingham, as he sat at the bar sipping a pint of beer.
And stupid.
Never in any doubt,
said Victor Kaufman.
Then that explains it. Explains what?
Asked Clive.
My uncle took me to Lord's last Thursday. To watch England thrash the Indians. True, but I met this girl.
Ah, the fog is lifting, said Victor.
And you fancied her, said Clive.
Yes, and what's more, I thought she quite liked me.
Then she must be dumb.
But when I called her the next day and asked her to dinner, she turned me down.
I like the sound of this woman.
So, as we both work in the city, I suggested lunch.
Has she still spurned you?
Out of hand, said Seb. So I asked her if she would consider dispensing with the meals and if she'd like to see Laurence Olivier in The Merchant of Venice.
Has she still turned you down?
She did.
But you can't get tickets for that show, even from touts, said Victor.
So I'll ask you again. Am I ugly?
We've already established that, said Clive. So all that's left to discuss is which one of us will be your date for Merchant.
Neither of you. I haven't given up yet.
I thought you told me you liked Sebastian.
I did. He was a wonderful company for a day I'd been dreading, said Priya.
So why did you turn him down?
Asked her flatmate.
It was just unfortunate that on all 3 days he asked me out, I already had something else on.
And you couldn't rearrange any of them?
Asked Jenny.
No, my father had invited me to the ballet on Wednesday evening. Margot Fontaine in Swan Lake.
Okay, I'll accept that one. Next.
On Thursday, my boss asked me to attend a lunch he was giving for an important client who was flying in from New Delhi.
Fair enough.
And on Friday, I always do my hair.
Pathetic.
I know. But by the time I'd thought about it, he was no longer on the line.
Pathetic,
Jenny repeated.
And worse, Dad rang the next day to say something had come up, and he had to fly to Bombay, and would I like the tickets? Fontaine in Swan Lake. Can I tempt you, Jenny?
You bet.
But I'm not going with you, because you were going to call Sebastian, tell him your father can't make it, and ask him if he'd like to join you.
I can't do that, said Priya. I couldn't possibly phone a man and ask him out.
Priya, it's 1971. It's no longer frowned upon for a woman to ask a man out.
It is in India.
But we're not in India, just in case you haven't noticed. And what's more, you phone men all the time.
No, I do not.
Yes, you do. It's part of your job, and you're rather good at it.
That's different.
So it will be all right to call Sebastian and discuss the drop in interest rates, but not to invite him to the ballet?
Perhaps he'll call me again.
And perhaps he won't.
Are you sure you don't want to see Fontaine?
Of course I do. And if you give me the tickets, I'll phone Sebastian and ask him if he'd like to be my date.
There's a Jenny Barton on line one, Mr. Clifton.
Jenny Barton. Doesn't ring a bell.
Did she say which company she's from?
No, she said it was a personal matter.
I can't place her, but I suppose you'd better put her through.
Good morning, Mr. Clifton. You don't know me, but I share a flat with Priya Guman.
Seb nearly dropped the phone.
You rang Priya yesterday and invited her to dinner.
And lunch and the theatre,
all of which she turned down. Which she now regrets. So if you were to call her again, I think you'll find she might be free on Wednesday night after all.
Thank you, Miss Barton, said Seb. But why didn't she call herself?
You may well ask. Because after what she told me about you, I certainly wouldn't have turned you down.
The line went dead.
I had no idea you were interested in the ballet, Sebastian. I always think of you as more of a theatre buff.
You're quite right, Mother. In fact, it will be my first visit to the Royal Opera House.
Then be warned, don't bother to have lunch.
What are you talking about?
It's all very civilized at Covent Garden. You have dinner throughout the evening. They serve the first course before the curtain goes up, the main course during the long interval, and coffee, cheese and biscuits after the curtain comes down. Who are you taking?
I'm not. I'm a guest.
Anyone I know?
Stop fishing, Mother.
Sebastian arrived at the Royal Opera House a few minutes before seven, surprised by how nervous he felt. But then, as Clive had so helpfully reminded him, it was his first date for some time. He scanned the crowd streaming through the front doors, and then he saw her. Not that he could have missed her. Priya's long dark hair and deep brown eyes were complemented by a striking red silk dress that made him feel she should be gracing the cover of Vogue rather than hidden away analyzing profits and losses in the deep recesses of a bank. Her face lit up the moment she spotted him.
Wow, he said. You look stunning.
Thank you, Priya replied, as Seb kissed her on the cheek, as if she were his Aunt Grace.
I'm sure you've been to the house many times before, she said, so you'll be familiar with the routine.
No, it's my first visit, admitted Seb. In fact, I've never been to the ballet before.
Lucky you.
What do you mean? Asked Seb, as they entered the restaurant on the ground floor.
You'll either be hooked for life, or you won't ever want to come again.
Yes, I know what you mean, said Seb. Priya stopped at the entrance.
We have a booking in the name of Guman.
Please follow me, madam, said the maitre d', who led them to their table, and once they were seated, handed each of them a menu.
They serve the first course before the curtain goes up, and we have to order the main course at the same time, so they can have it ready for us at the interval.
Are you always this organized?
I'm so sorry, said Priya. I was only trying to help.
And I was only teasing, said Seb. But then when you've got a mother like mine, it goes with the territory.
Your mother is a remarkable lady, Seb. I wonder if she knows just how many women look upon her as a role model.
A waiter appeared at their side, his order pad open.
I'll have the asparagus and Dover sole, said Priya.
And I'll have the duck pate and a lamb chop, said Seb. And I'd like to order a bottle of wine.
I don't drink, said Priya.
I'm sorry, what would you like?
Water will be fine, thank you. But don't let me stop you.
Seb checked the wine list.
I'll have a glass of Merlot, he said. As a banker, said Priya, you'd approve of how well this place is run. Most of the courses are simple and easy to prepare, so when you return to your table at the end of each act, they can serve you quickly.
I can see why you're an analyst.
And you head up the property division of Farthings, which must be quite a responsibility for someone
of my age? As you well know, banking is a young man's game. Most of my colleagues are burnt out by 40.
Some at 30.
And it still can't be easy for a woman to make headway in the city.
One or two of the banks are slowly coming round to accepting that it's just possible a woman might be as bright as a man. However, most of the older establishments are still living in the Dark Ages. Which school you went to, or who your father is, often outranks ability or qualifications. Hambro's is less Neanderthal than most, but they still don't have a woman on the board, which is also true of every other major bank in the city, including Farthing's.
Three bells rang. Does that mean the players are about to come out onto the pitch?
As you're a regular theatre-goer, you'll know that's the three-minute bell.
Seb followed her out of the restaurant and into the auditorium, as she seemed to know exactly where she was going. He wasn't surprised when they were shown to the best seats in the house. From the moment the curtain rose and the little swans fluttered out onto the stage, Seb was transported into another world. He was captivated by the dancers' skills and artistry, and just when he thought it couldn't get any better, the prima ballerina made her entrance, and he knew he would be returning again and again. When the curtain fell at the end of the second act and the applause had died down, Priya led him back to the restaurant.
"Well, what do you think?" she asked as they sat down. "I was spellbound," he said, looking directly at her. "And I enjoyed Margot Fonteyn's performance as well."
Priya laughed.
"My father first took me to the ballet when I was 7 years old. Like all little girls, I left the theatre wanting to be one of the four signets, and it's been an unbroken love affair ever since.
I had the same feeling when my father first took me to Stratford to see Paul Robeson in Othello," Seb said, as a lamb chop was placed in front of him.
"How fortunate you are."
Seb looked puzzled.
"You'll now be able to see all the great ballets for the first time. Mind you, starting with Fonteyn won't make it easy for those who follow her."
"My father once told me," said Seb, "that he wished he'd never read a word of Shakespeare until he was 30. Then he could have seen all 37 plays without knowing the endings. I now realize exactly what he meant."
"I just don't get to the theatre enough. I did invite you to The Merchant of Venice, but I had something on that night. But I can now get out of it, so I'd love to go with you, assuming you haven't offered the ticket to someone else."
"I'm sorry, but two of my friends were desperate to see Olivier, so..."
"I understand," said Priya.
"But I turned them down."
"Why?"
"They both have hairy legs." Priya burst out laughing.
"I know you. Where do you..."
"No, you first," said Priya.
"I just have so many questions I want to ask you."
"Me too." "I know you went to St. Paul's and then Girton, but why banking?"
"I've always been fascinated by figures and the patterns they create, especially when you have to explain their significance to men, who so often are only interested in a short-term gain.
Like me, perhaps."
"I hope not, Seb."
It could have been Samantha speaking. He wouldn't make the same mistake a second time.
"How long have you been with Hambrose?"
"Just over 3 years."
"So you must be thinking about your next move."
"So like a man," said Priya.
"No, I'm very happy where I am, although I do get depressed when inadequate men are promoted to positions above their actual ability. I wish banking was like the ballet. If it was, Margot Fonteyn would be governor of the Bank of England."
"I don't think Sir Leslie O'Brien would make a very good black swan," said Seb, as the three-minute bell rang. He quickly drained his glass of wine. Priya was right, because Seb couldn't take his eyes off the black swan, who mesmerized the entire audience with her brilliance. And when the curtain fell at the end of Act Three, he was desperate to find out what would happen in the final act.
"Don't tell me, don't tell me," he said, as they returned to their table.
"I won't," said Priya.
"But savor the moment, because sadly you can only have this unique experience once. Perhaps you'll have the same experience when I take you to the Merchant of Venice. How sweet the moonlight sleeps upon this bank. Here will we sit and let the sounds of music creep in our ears. Soft stillness and the night become the touches of sweet harmony. Sit, Jessica. Look how..."
Sebastian bowed his head.
"I'm so sorry," said Priya. "What did I say?"
Nothing. Nothing.
You just reminded me of something."
"Or someone?" Seb was rescued by the tannoy. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please take your seats? The final act is about to begin. The final act was so moving and Fontaine so captivating that when Seb turned to see if it was having the same effect on Priya, he thought he saw a tear trickling down her cheek. He took her hand.
"Sorry," she whispered. "I'm making a fool of myself. That wouldn't be possible."
When the curtain finally fell, Seb joined in the 10-minute standing ovation, and Margot Fontaine received so many curtain calls and bouquets, she could have opened a flower shop. As they left the auditorium, he took Priya's hand as they strolled back to the restaurant, but she seemed nervous and didn't speak. Once coffee had been served, Priya said,
"Thank you for a wonderful evening. Being with you was like seeing Swan Lake for the first time. I haven't enjoyed a performance so much in a long time."
She hesitated.
"But something is worrying you. I'm a Hindu."
Seb burst out laughing. "And I'm a Somerset yokel, but it's never worried me." She didn't laugh.
"I don't think I can come to the theater with you, Seb."
"But why not?"
"I'm frightened of what might happen if we see each other again."
"I don't understand."
"I told you my father had to return to India."
"Yes, I assumed on business."
"Of a kind. My mother has spent the past few months selecting the man I will be expected to marry. And I think she's made her final choice."
"No," said Seb. "That can't be possible."
"All that's needed now is my father's approval."
"You have no choice? No say in the matter?"
"None. You have to understand, Seb, it's part of our tradition, our heritage, and our religious beliefs."
"But what if he were to fall in love with someone else?"
"I would still have to honor my parents' wishes."
Seb leant across the table to take her hand, but she quickly withdrew it.
"I will never forget the night I saw Swan Lake with you, Seb. I will cherish the memory for the rest of my life."
"And so will I, but surely..." But when he looked up, like the black swan, she had disappeared. Chapter 17.
"So, how did last night go?"
asked Jenny, as she placed two eggs in a saucepan of warm water.
"It couldn't have been much worse,"
Priya replied.
"Didn't work out at all as I'd planned."
Jenny turned round to see her friend on the verge of tears. She rushed across, sat down beside her, and put an arm around her shoulder.
"That bad? Worse. I liked him even more the second time, and I blame you."
"Why me?"
"Because if you'd agreed to come to the ballet with me, none of this would have happened."
"But that's good."
"No, it's awful. At the end of the evening, I walked out on him, after telling him I never wanted to see him again."
"What did he do to make you so angry?"
"He made me fall in love with him, which wasn't what I intended."
"But that's fantastic, if he feels the same way."
"But it can only end in disaster when our parents..."
"I'm pretty sure Seb's parents will welcome you as a member of their family. Everything I've ever read about them suggests they're extremely civilized."
"It's not his parents I'm worried about, it's mine. They just wouldn't consider Sebastian as suitable..."
"We're living in the modern world, Priya. Mixed-race marriage is becoming quite the thing. You should take your parents to see guess who's coming to dinner."
"Jenny, a black man wanting to marry a white woman in 1960s America is nothing compared to a Hindu falling in love with a Christian, believe me. Did you notice in that film they never once discussed religion, only the color of his skin? I realize it's not unknown for an Indian to marry someone of a different race, especially if they're both Christians. But it's not something a Hindu would ever consider. If only I hadn't gone to that cricket match."
"But you did," said Jenny, "so you'll have to deal with reality.
Would you rather try and build a worthwhile relationship with Sebastian, or please your parents by marrying a man you've never met? I just wish it was that simple. I tried to explain to Seb last night what it's like to be brought up in a traditional Hindu household, where heritage, duty, what about love? That can come after marriage. I know it did for my mother and father. But your father's met Sebastian, so surely he'll understand. The possibility of his daughter marrying a Christian will never even have crossed his mind. He's an international businessman who sent you to St. Paul's and was so proud when you won a place at Cambridge. Yes, and he made it possible for me to achieve those things and has never asked for anything in return. But when it comes to who I should marry, he'll be immovable, and I'll be expected to obey him. I've always accepted that. My brother was married to someone he'd never met, and my younger sister is already being prepared to go through the same process. I could face defying my parents if I felt that in time they might come round, but I know they never will. But surely they must accept that there's a new world order, and things have changed. Not for the better, as my mother never tires of telling me.
Jenny ran across to the stove as the water bubbled over the rim of the saucepan and rescued two very hard-boiled eggs. They both laughed.
So what are you going to do about it?
Asked Jenny.
There's nothing I can do. I told him we couldn't see each other again, and I meant it.
There was a firm rap on the front door.
I'll bet that's him, said Jenny. Then you have to answer it. Sorry, got another egg to boil, and can't afford to make the same mistake twice.
A second rap on the door, even firmer.
Get on with it, said Jenny, remaining by the stove.
Priya prepared a little speech as she walked slowly into the hall.
I'm sorry, but...
she began as she opened the front door to find a young man standing on the doorstep holding a red rose.
Are you Miss Priya Guman?
He said.
Yes. I was asked to give you this.
Priya thanked him, closed the door and returned to the kitchen.
Was it him?
Asked Jenny.
No, but he sent this,
she said, holding up the rose.
I really must start going to more cricket matches,
said Jenny.
On the hour, every hour?
Asked Clive.
That's right. And for just how long do you intend to keep sending her a rose on the hour, every hour?
Asked Victor.
For as long as it takes. There's got to be one very happy florist out there somewhere. Tell me, Vic, do Jewish parents feel as strongly about their children marrying outside their faith?
I have to admit, said Vic, when my parents invited Ruth to dinner 3 Fridays in a row, I knew the only thing I was going to be allowed to choose was the vegetables.
How can we even begin to understand the pressure Priya must be facing?
Said Clive.
I feel for her.
On a lighter note, Seb, said Victor, does this mean you won't be taking her to the Merchant of Venice at the National tonight?
It seems unlikely, so you may as well have my tickets.
He took out his wallet and handed them to Clive.
Hope you both enjoy it.
We could toss a coin, said Victor, to decide which one of us goes with you.
No, I have other plans for tonight.
It's Miss Jenny Barton on line 3, Mr. Clifton.
Put her through.
Hi, Seb. I was just going to say hang in there. She's weakening.
But she hasn't replied to any of my letters, doesn't answer my calls, won't acknowledge.
Perhaps you should try to see her.
I see her every day, said Seb. I'm standing outside Hambro's when she turns up for work in the morning, and again when she catches her bus in the evening. I'm even there when she gets back to her flat at night. If I try any harder, I could be arrested for stalking.
I'm visiting my parents in Norfolk this weekend, said Jenny, and I won't be back until Monday morning. I can't do much more to help, so get on with it.
It was raining when Priya left the bank on Friday evening. She put up her umbrella and kept her head down, looking out for puddles as she made her way to the bus stop. Of course, he was waiting for her, as he had been every night that week.
Good evening, Miss Guman, he said.
and handed her a rose.
"Thank you,"
she replied, before joining the queue. Priya climbed on board the bus and took a seat on the top deck. She glanced out of the window, and for a moment thought she spotted Seb hiding in the shadows of a shop doorway. When she got off the bus in Fulham Road, another young man, another rose, another thank you. She ran to the flat as the rain became heavier by the minute. By the time she put her key in the front door, she was frozen. She decided on a quick supper, a warm bath, and early bed, and tonight she would even try and get some sleep. She was taking a yogurt out of the fridge when the doorbell rang. She smiled and checked her watch, the last rose of the day, which would join all the others in the vase on the hall table. Wondering just how long Seb would keep this up, she walked quickly to the door, not wanting the young man to get drenched. She opened it to find him standing there, an umbrella in one hand, a rose in the other. Priya slammed the door in his face, sank to the floor, and burst into tears. How could she continue to treat him so badly, when she was the one to blame? She sat in the hallway, hunched up against the wall. It was some time before she slowly picked herself up and made her way back to the kitchen. The light was fading, so she walked across to the window and drew the curtains. It was still raining, what the English describe as cats and dogs. And then she saw him, head down, sitting on the curb on the far side of the road, rain cascading off his umbrella into the gutter. She stared at him through the tiny gap in the curtain, but he couldn't see her. She must tell him to go home before he caught pneumonia. She ran to the door, opened it, and shouted, "Sebastian!" He looked up.
"Please go home."
He stood up, and she knew she should have closed the door immediately. He began walking slowly across the road towards her, half expecting the door to be slammed in his face again. But she didn't close it, so he stepped forward and took her in his arms.
"I don't want to go on living if I can't be with you," he said. "I feel the same way, but you must realize it's hopeless. I'll go and see your father as soon as he comes back from India. I can't believe he won't understand." "It won't make any difference. Then we'll have to do something about it before he returns. The first thing we're going to have to do is get you out of that suit. You're soaking."
As she took off his jacket, he leaned forward and began to undo the tiny buttons on her blouse.
"I'm not soaking," she said.
"I know,"
he whispered, as they continued to undress each other. He took her in his arms and kissed her for the first time. They fumbled around like teenagers, discovering each other's bodies slowly, gently. So when they finally made love, for Sebastian, it was as if it was for the first time. For Priya, it was the first time. For the rest of the weekend, they never left each other, even for a moment. They ran together in the park each morning. She cooked while he laid the table. They went to the cinema, not watching much of the film, laughed and cried, and lost count of how many times they made love. The happiest weekend of her life, she told him on Monday morning.
"Let me tell you about my master plan,"
he said as they sat down for breakfast.
"Does it begin with making love in the corridor?"
"No, but let's do that every Friday night. I'll stand out in the rain."
"And I'll tell you to go home."
"Home. That reminds me, my master plan. Next weekend, I want to take you down to the West Country so you can meet my parents."
"I'm so worried they won't..."
"Think I'm good enough for you? They'd be right. I suspect the real problem will be convincing your father that I'll ever be good enough for you. But I'll go and see him the moment he's back in England."
"What will you say to him?"
"I've fallen in love with your daughter, and I want to spend the rest of my life with her."
"But you haven't even proposed."
"I would have done at Lord's, but I knew you'd only laugh at me."
"He won't laugh. He'll only ask you one thing,"
she said softly.
"And what will that be, my darling?"
Her words were barely audible.
"Have you slept
with my daughter.
If he does, I'll tell him the truth.
Then he'll either kill you or me or both of us.
Seb took her back in his arms.
He'll come round once he sees how much we care for each other. Not if my mother's already chosen a suitable man for me to marry, and the two families have come to an understanding. Because just before my father flew to India, I gave him my word I was still a virgin.
During the week, Seb spoke to his mother and father, and they were not only delighted by his news, but couldn't wait to meet their future daughter-in-law. Priya was heartened by their response, but couldn't hide how anxious she was about how her father would react. He phoned her on Thursday to say he was on his way back to England and had some exciting news to share with her.
"And we have some exciting news to share with him," said Seb,
trying to reassure her. On Friday evening, Seb left the bank early, only stopping off on the way to buy another bunch of roses. He then continued across town to the Fulham Road to pick up Priya before they travelled down to the West Country together. He couldn't wait to introduce her to his parents. But first he must thank Jenny for all she'd done to make it possible, and this time he would give the roses to her. He parked outside the flat, jumped out of the car and rang the doorbell. It was some time before the door opened, and when it did he felt his legs give way. Jenny stood there shaking uncontrollably, a red swelling on her cheek.
"What's happened?"
he demanded.
"They've taken her away."
"What do you mean?"
"Her father and brother turned up about an hour ago. She put up a fight and tried to help, but the two of them dragged her out of the flat, threw her in the back of a car and drove off."
Chapter 18.
"It was good of you to see us at such short notice, Varun," said Giles, "especially on a Saturday morning."
"My pleasure," said the High Commissioner. "My country will always be in your debt for the role you played as Foreign Minister when Mrs. Gandhi visited the United Kingdom. But how can I help, Lord Barrington? You said on the phone the matter was urgent."
"My nephew, Sebastian Clifton, has a personal problem he'd like your advice on."
"Of course. If I can assist in any way, I will be happy to do so," he said,
turning to face the young man.
"I've come up against what seems to be an intractable problem, sir, and I don't know what to do about it."
Mr. Sharma nodded.
"I've fallen in love with an Indian girl, and I want to marry her."
"Congratulations."
"But she's a Hindu. As are 80% of my countrymen, Mr. Clifton, myself included. Therefore, should I assume the problem is not the girl, but her parents?"
"Yes, sir. Although Priya wants to marry me, her parents have chosen someone else to be her husband. Someone she hasn't even met."
"That's not uncommon in my country, Mr. Clifton. I didn't meet my wife until my mother had selected her. But if you think it might help, I will be happy to have a word with Priya's parents and try to plead your case."
"That's very kind of you, sir. I'd be most grateful."
"However, I must warn you that if the family has settled the contract with the other parties concerned, my words may well fall on deaf ears. But please," continued the High Commissioner, as he picked up a notepad from the table by his side, "tell me everything you can about Priya before I decide how to approach the problem."
"Yesterday evening, Priya and I had planned to drive down to the West Country so she could meet my parents. When I arrived at her flat to pick her up, I found that she had, quite literally, been kidnapped by her father and brother."
"May I know their names?"
"Suki and Simran Guman."
The High Commissioner shifted uneasily in his chair.
"Mr. Guman is one of India's leading industrialists. He has very strong business and political connections, and I should add that he also has a reputation
for ruthless efficiency. I choose my words carefully, Mr. Clifton.
But if Priya is still in England, surely we can prevent him from taking her back to India against her will. She is, after all, 26 years old.
I doubt if she's still in this country, Mr. Clifton, because I know Mr. Gooman has a private jet. But even if she were, proving a father is holding his child against her wishes would involve a long legal process. I have experienced 7 such cases since I took up this post, and although I'm convinced all 7 young women wish to remain in this country, 4 of them were back in India long before they could be questioned, and the other 3, when interviewed, said they no longer wanted to claim asylum. But if you wish to pursue the matter, I can call the chief inspector at Scotland Yard, who is responsible for such cases. Though I should warn you that Mr. Gooman will be well aware of his legal rights, and it won't be the first time he's taken the law into his own hands.
Are you saying there's nothing I can do?
Not a great deal, admitted the High Commissioner. And I only wish I could be more helpful.
It was good of you to spare us so much of your time, Varun, said Giles as he stood up.
My pleasure, Giles, said the High Commissioner.
The 2 men shook hands.
Don't hesitate to be in touch if you feel I can be of any assistance.
As Giles and Seb left Varun Sharma's office and walked out onto the Strand, Giles said, I'm so sorry, Seb. I know exactly what you're going through, but I'm not sure what you can do next.
Go home and try to get on with my life.
But thank you, Uncle Giles. You couldn't have done more. Giles watched as his nephew strode off in the direction of the city and wondered what he really planned to do next, because his home was in the opposite direction. Once Seb was out of sight, Giles headed back up the steps and into the High Commissioner's office.
Rachel, I need £500 in rupees, an open-ended return ticket to Bombay, and an Indian visa. If you call Mr. Sharma's secretary at the High Commission, I'm sure she'll speed the whole process up. Oh, and I'll need 50 minutes with the chairman before I leave.
But you have several important appointments next week, including...
Clear my diary for the next few days. I'll phone in every morning, so you can keep me fully briefed.
This must be one hell of a deal you're trying to close.
The biggest of my life.
The High Commissioner listened carefully to what his secretary had to say.
Your nephew has just called and applied for a visa, he said, after putting the phone down. Do I speed it up or slow it down?
Speed it up, said Giles, although I admit I'm quite anxious about the boy. Like me, he's a hopeless romantic, and at the moment he's thinking with his heart and not his head.
Don't worry, Giles, said Varun. I'll see that someone keeps an eye on him while he's in India, and try to make sure he doesn't get into too much trouble, especially as Suki Gooman is involved. No one needs that man as an enemy.
But when I met him at Lord's, he seemed quite charming.
That's half the reason he's so successful.
It wasn't until later that evening, when Seb had fastened his seatbelt and the plane had taken off, that he realized he didn't have a plan. All he knew for certain was that he couldn't spend the rest of his life wondering if this journey just might have made a difference. The only piece of useful information he picked up from the chief steward during the flight was the name of the best hotel in Bombay. Seb was dozing when the captain announced that they were about to begin their descent into Bombay. He looked out of the cabin window to see a vast, sprawling mass of tiny houses, shacks, and tenement blocks filling every inch of space. He could only wonder if Bombay had any planning laws. As he left the aircraft and walked down the steps, he was immediately overwhelmed by the oppressive humidity, and once he'd entered the airport, he quickly discovered the local pace of everything. Slow or stop. Having his passport checked, the longest queue he'd ever seen, waiting for his luggage to be unloaded from the hold, he nearly fell asleep, being held up by customs, although he only had one suitcase,
and then trying to find a taxi when there wasn't an official rank. They just seemed to come and go. When Seb finally set off for the city, he discovered why no one was ever booked for speeding in Bombay, because the car rarely got out of first gear. And when he asked about air conditioning, the driver wound down his window. He stared out of the open window at the little shops. No roofs, no doors, trading everything from spare tires to mangoes, while the citizens of Bombay went about their business. Some were dressed in smart suits that hung loosely on their bodies, and ties that wouldn't have been out of place in the Square Mile, while others wore spotless loincloths, bringing to mind the image of Gandhi, one of his father's heroes. Once they'd reached the outskirts of the city, they came to a halt. Seb had experienced traffic jams in London, New York, and Tokyo, but they were Formula One racetracks compared to Bombay. Broken-down lorries parked in the fast lane, overcrowded rickshaws on the inside lane, and sacred cows munched happily away in the centre lane, while old women crossed the road seemingly unaware